if I'm Mark and Denise's seaweed venture company and I'm going to start today, and I discover that it could be 2 to 5 year process in getting a license, that is a monumental deterrent for any business to look at, to go, am I going to roll the dice? I might have to buy equipment. I might need infrastructure. I need staff. Like, how do you do all that when you're not even quite sure if the outcome is going to be there? And I think in trying to build out a net new sector and opportunity, it's going to take some time. It's complex. And there's a whole host of moving parts.
Hello, I'm Denise Withers, and you've just joined The Quest for Good, an interview series where innovators from coders to CEOs share stories about how they overcome obstacles to create breakthrough change. If you're looking for a better way to take your work to the next level, then stay tuned, because I have just the story for you. Bringing an innovation to market is a huge challenge. You not only have to figure out how to fund, design, build, manufacture, and distribute your innovation, but you also have to develop a new market for it, teach people what it is, how it makes their lives better, and why they should buy it. Now, imagine having to do that for not just a single product, but an entire industry. The magnitude and complexities of the challenge are incredible, and Mark Smith is loving every minute of it. As the president and CEO of the newly formed Pacific Seaweed Industry Association, Mark's working with growers, manufacturers, investors, and especially governments to generate the support needed to take seaweed production to scale and do it in a way that's environmentally, economically, and culturally sustainable. If he and his colleagues, including First Nations, are successful, they'll build a blue economy across the country that generates thousands of new jobs and helps us tackle climate change. I know Mark's keen to tell us more about their work, so let's dive into this conversation. Hello, Mark, and welcome.
Thank you for having me. Thrilled to be here and share a little about what we're up to.
Okay, I know that you've got big things planned for the future of the seaweed industry in Canada, but before we get to that, it would be great if you could start us off by telling us a bit about how this all got started for you.
So a little over 3 years ago, pre-pandemic, I was actively involved in an organization called the Vancouver Island Economic Alliance, where the sole mandate there is really about driving and building out the island economy. And we were successful in getting the island designated as a foreign trade zone. And our objective there was to be able to leverage that to create, attract foreign direct investment, to really start scaling up a multitude of opportunities on the island, get companies export ready, was one of the mandates, and to build things at scale, again, to build out the island economy. And the reason I bring all of that up and how it hangs together with seaweed is that when we were successful in convincing the federal government to designate Vancouver Island as a foreign trade zone, the first thing we did was we retained an external consultancy and we had them create some business cases around what the opportunities were around the island that were quantified, as opposed to a group of guys like myself and gals around a table making things up. And they came back with, you know, tourism was on the list, but it was aquaculture, which was no surprise to anybody on the West Coast, but it was really the subset of seaweed that came out of that. So one of the fellows on our panel, Bill Collins, who still remains on that panel today, really did a deep dive into this and ended up creating a company called Cascadia Seaweed, which has now grown to be one of the largest cultivators in Canada, certainly on the west coast of Canada. And off we went. And as we furthered those discussions and started to look at this as a sector opportunity, we realized that this was a monumental opportunity for both British Columbia and now kind of us from a Canadian viewpoint. So we knew that to start to tell that story, we knew that that probably shouldn't and couldn't come from privately held companies. So hence, we created an association. And we started as the Pacific Seaweed Growers Association. So we're 2.5 years in, and we're really just getting to the formative stages, putting together operating budgets, doing all the great things you do, just like a startup business, whether it's a nonprofit or not. But we started out as the growers, and about a year in, we actually went through a rebrand. And we became the Pacific Seaweed Industry Association. And the reason we did that is in our first year, in a host of conversations with a number of organizations, it became apparent to us that the perception was that we were really just about farming and cultivating. And I always like to say, mission critical. Without the farmers and the cultivation happening, we have no industry. But the reality is, to build out an entire sector, we need to represent all of that. And that could be from the venture capitalist to the food processing to the exporters to the shipping company. So it's the whole ecosystem. So that's the genesis of where we're at. And yours truly was around at the beginning. And my disclaimer is always that 3 years ago, I was relatively uneducated in the kelp and seaweed space. And I'm certainly not the science, but I firmly believe that I'm now beyond passionate about seeing this emerge as a sectoral opportunity. And on the west coast of British Columbia, on Vancouver Island, we could and should have the ability to build out the entire ecosystem from farming to production to distribution.
That's such a great story, and there's so much potential there. And then, so tell me about seaweed. How did seaweed rise up and become the cream of the crop kind of thing? Because especially when you think about Vancouver Island, you're going to think about forestry and things like that.
Yeah, well, I have to state for the record that it's like, you know, it's not a new industry. And when we put that in a British Columbia context, the difference, I would say, at this point, at least from our lens and what we're trying to achieve, is that it hasn't been done at scale.
Yeah.
And I have to say, Denise, what I've also come to learn myself in a lot of these conversations in the past couple of years, I'm very careful of how I use the word scale in this industry. And what I mean by that is, you know, we can grow this industry. We can have hundreds of farms up and down the coast, but we have a lot of coastline. So where there's areas, countries, pockets in the world that have developed out the sector where literally you might have a 30, 40, 50 kilometer run up and down the coastline, and it's nothing but farm after farm after farm after farm, that's not the vision. Right? There is a balance in there. And we have to play out to all of those things around the environmental piece, the climate considerations, all of the other things, the existing ecosystems in those marine environments. And we always defer to the science to help us get to scale. But we need to get going. British Columbia needs to get going, or we're going to miss the opportunity.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great reminder. So my next question then is, why focus on sea plants? What's the opportunity there? Tell us a bit about that.
Again, I'm not the expert, but you know, there's a lot of studies and lots of things underway globally. And if you just take things like kelp reforestation, bringing some of those areas up and down the coast back up to once where they were, could have been 100, 200, thousands of years ago, depending on the area and where you're at. You know, those are important environmental considerations that impact all of us every single day. The other piece is that from a food security on a global standpoint, we're 8 billion now on track, evidently by 2050, there's going to be 12 billion people. That's a lot of people to feed. And when you look at the ocean, and this is a global movement afoot, at the end of the day, where's all that food coming? The ocean in general is an underutilized asset. We have to be careful how we use that and manage that process. But at the end of the day, it is going to be mission critical to that piece of the formula for the world going forward. And that's a big, bold statement, but that's a fact.
And so I want to dive a bit deeper, pun intended this time, and really look at some of the specifics here. So a lot of people might not know what a kelp forest is. And my understanding of kelp forests is that they provide ecosystem services, like they protect the coastline from storm surge, and they provide habitat for baby fish to grow up in, and we can eat seaweed. And so can you give us a few more specifics around some of the things that we can do with the products that would be produced?
Well, I would start by saying, back to the British Columbia coastal and Vancouver Island specifically, the research that's been done to date, the studies show that there's over 600 different varieties of seaweed that grow in and around the island. So you might have a farm where you harvest a specific variety, and when you haul that out, and then you either fast freeze it because you have to have somewhere to keep that product to get into a usable state for future use, and or you dry it and create basically, if you can picture, flakes, as it were, of seaweed, which makes it easier and lighter to haul around in a truck, which might go to a different production center somewhere off of the island. And food is a big piece of it, can be used in a whole host of products. Again, in a powder type format, there's other ingredients, protein additives, all of those check boxes. But there's a big movement afoot. For example, one of our member companies here, Cascadia Seaweed, they're working on, they've received some significant government funding, federal funding to help them along the way, is that globally there's a movement that if you add seaweed to cattle feed, it provides a monumental methane reduction. So, of course, with the methane, part of the challenge globally is to reduce those methane gases. When you've got something that you can add 5% additive and have like upwards of a 95% methane reduction, it's a great business case.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in there a little bit because you know so much about this, and there's people out there who are trying to put two and two together right now. And
yes.
I'll just come out and say it. So the seaweed means that the cows fart less. Is that correct?
That takes the year. Hang on. Exactly.
Right.
Correct. Yes, exactly. And, you know, converting seaweed into things like cosmetic, into nutraceuticals, and pharmaceuticals, there's looking at additives and things, lots of research being done in that space. One of the things that gets me super excited is there's a big movement afoot globally around biopackaging. So I'm old school, so I always use the example of like old school saran wrap on the roll where you take out your plastic to put something in the fridge. And there's processes and companies around the world that are working on this. They're converting seaweed into product packaging.
Wow, there's so much innovation going on in this space. That's fantastic. And then there's also a blue carbon element to all of this. Can you tell us a bit about that and how growing our seaweed industry can also help us with our climate change efforts?
Yes, 100%. And again, in one of those things around, you know, we defer to the science. And the reason I bring that up specifically in the carbon space, and, you know, for a lot of the listeners and folks like ourselves out there, I mean, you hear all of these things around carbon credits. I travel on a plane today and I can now pay an extra fee and buy some carbon credits to offset the distance I just traveled. What does that look like? And around that, I'm not going to say the jury is out, but there's a number of position papers and monumental research that's going to speak very eloquently to the science and opportunity of blue carbon. What we know is there for sure is an opportunity. It sequesters and holds carbon. So we know that it's a great big opportunity. And there are companies specifically targeting into that space. And an interesting side note, just last week, Amazon invested 1.5 million euros into it's a consortium, I think is the best way to describe it, of scientific community folks in Holland. And they are it's going to be the largest scale seaweed farm in that area, that neck of the woods, perhaps globally. And they're doing it out in and around where the wind turbines are, offshore. And that mandate is strictly around creating a scenario in the carbon space.
Right.
So the big corporate guys are also, you know, there's a lot of movement afoot and interest globally about what's happening in this space.
And even if the carbon credits as a business doesn't come to pass, the fact is that increasing seaweed production will lock up some carbon one way or another.
100%. Exactly. Yeah. And where I was kind of going, and I probably didn't articulate it very well, but when I say like the jury's out, it's like today there's not a formula. If I was a farmer in traditional agriculture and I moved this amount of soil, like you can quantify that scientifically and go, well, that's the net carbon output or whatever, like good, bad, or indifferent. And all of that work is kind of being done to go, well, what is the measurement in as it relates to blue carbon?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so there's all of these amazing things happening and there's this incredible opportunity. What are some of the biggest barriers standing in the way of taking this industry to scale and really building it out as a sector?
I think from a Canadian standpoint, British Columbia standpoint, is the regulatory framework. So the licensing piece to get into seaweed farming at significant scale is complicated. And whether it's the Department of Fisheries and Oceans or the provincial Ministry of Ag here that looks at it, involved in the licensing process in British Columbia, it is important that all of the homework is done so we don't do things like, well, let's just put out a farm off in Nanaimo and now we introduce an invasive species, hypothetically, right? So there's all those considerations. But that said, now when I put on my business hat to try and push and accelerate the growth of this forward, I still say, but we need to start trying some things. Let's not go do the largest farm in North America. Let's start with some test and pilot farms, and let's make that regulatory and part of the research process a little more accessible. So to try and answer the question a little more thoughtfully, in the growth process, if I'm Mark and Denise's seaweed venture company, and I'm going to start today, and I start going down the path, and I discover that it could be 2 to 5 year process in getting a license, that is a monumental deterrent for any business to look at, to go, am I going to roll the dice? I might have to buy equipment. I might need infrastructure. I might need a building. I need staff. Like, how do you do all that when you're not even quite sure if the outcome is going to be there? Which basically, it creates a segue into part two of that challenge. Like any other business, and think of it as a startup, emerging opportunity, is then it's access to capital. So, you know, if you need, I'm just going to throw out a number, $500,000 to start your farm, and you don't have the luxury of having $500,000 of personal capital kicking around, you have to go raise money to start a company. So how do you attract investors for what could be a longer term return? Because we're working on building metrics around the world. But when it's such a new piece, we really need some, it could be corporations, it could be philanthropic folks to kind of step up and go, we believe in that, we're going to support that. And that's starting to happen, which is the great news around the world. So financial, regulatory, and I think just a general movement. And interestingly enough, certainly there's a movement afoot globally for what is called, we call it polyculture because it's easier, but the other terminology is multitrophic farming. So you might have an existing oyster farm, for example, and common practice in other areas around the world is that you then also lay in a seaweed farm. And there's benefits of nutrients and things, and they coexist well together. The state of Maine, for example, has revitalized the lobster industry by doing this, where the lobster guy might be harvesting and busy being a lobster fisherman for 7 or 8 months of the year. We'll take the other 4 months and during that downtime and create year-round revenues for those folks. So a lot of the things and jobs and opportunities and these other farming instances that already exist, they could be repurposed and add on potential new revenue streams, new products, the infrastructure exists. So there's a lot of plus sides there. Like we started to talk about the rural development, the coastal communities, indigenous business opportunities. Like we check a lot of boxes. Yeah. We check a lot of boxes.
Yeah, that's fantastic work. And I want to pick up, I've been trying to resist actually. I mean, you've mentioned telling your story a few times. And so when you think about the existing narrative about the ocean and about aquaculture, how are you trying to change that? What's the story that you want people to be telling about aquaculture or about agriculture?
I think just in short that the ocean, I firmly believe, is, and this might sound like a harsh corporate statement, it's an untapped resource. But I mean that in the most positive way, because when one starts to get entrenched and understand really the opportunities, not just financial, but just the opportunities in general, again, to checking so many boxes, it's just a natural place to be. And as a guy who was born on the prairies, but's lived on the West Coast for all of my basically schooling, high school, and professional life, I've come to love the West Coast. And I love the ocean, right? So I think, you know, I was speaking to a group in California a few weeks ago, and they were telling me a story that I think was around the 1850s. They have all the old mappings from the U.S. Department of, I would say, geography, whatever the title was at that point in time. And there was a point in time, like in the 1850s, 1860s, that's not that long ago, where if you picture from basically the Mexican border up to San Francisco, is that the kelp forests and all that were so thick and so healthy and so lush in those areas and providing a whole host of benefits that we're starting to talk about, you would be hard pressed in some of those areas to be able to get a ship into port because you couldn't get through the kelp forest. That was not that long ago. But it's interesting because globally, when you start to look at organizations that are involved in the United States, and I know this through conversations with folks specifically in California, that the insurance sector is looking at the blue economy and seaweed as an investment opportunity. And one might go, how would you connect those dots? And the example I just cited around these thick forests is that somebody in California made the business case, which I think is quite frankly brilliant, to the insurance sectors to go, so imagine in 20 years from now, the big wave comes along and it potentially is going to threaten and take out, I don't know, Santa Barbara. I'm making up geography here. But mathematically, and they could model through technology to go, hypothetically, if it did all of this damage, this would be the dollar value. But if some of those forests and all of those things were in there to serve as a bit of a protective layer, instead of $50 billion in damage, maybe there's only going to be $36 billion. Again, I'm making up numbers, but it's significant. And those are things that, quite frankly, affect all of us. And it's kind of one of those things, it becomes so big. And I know that's what keeps me up at night, because it's kind of like, well, where am I going to start tomorrow? Am I starting in helping food production? Is it the cattle thing? Is it just getting the industry going? All of the above.
And how do you, I want to come back to the leadership piece for a second. So you personally as a leader, like how do you make that decision where you're going to focus your energies? How do you manage that?
I'm probably not very good at it, being fully transparent. I'm probably not that good at it. What I would say is we call ourselves the Core Four, and there's four of us. And, you know, some of us, you know, we're for the most part a volunteer army. We have some amazing people on our team that are working and doing whatever they can on a daily basis to move some of these initiatives forward. And the second piece of that is I'm lucky enough that building bridges and talking to at least one person in the space every single day, somewhere in the world, today it happened to be in the province of Quebec, that are doing these amazing things in these amazing spaces. So things seem to start to be coming our way. And dare I make the statement that a lot of people say this right now, is that seaweed, as one starts to investigate into it, is very topical in 2023. And seaweed is currently sexy, which means it attracts a whole host of folks. And for guys like me, I guess, trying to lead and build out the space, it's about getting all these best world-class people that we have and let them do their best work. Where we struggle is our challenge is chicken and egg. So we've got a few companies now that are getting very active that are started. They're two fellows on the West Coast. They've received their license as we speak. They're laying into the water. It's going to be one of the largest footprint seaweed farms, certainly up and down the West Coast. And one of their markets is going to be in and around food, which means now you need the ecosystem to do the production. And so concurrently, for guys like me, I'm trying to sell the story to municipalities, to government, all of that, to go, let's build out the production system. And of course, the first question I get is, yeah, but there's no production. And we're like, well, we're building production. So, but when we get production, hypothetically in 2 to 5 years, and we have no processing, it's difficult. So what I've come to accept is that we need to be doing all those things, which might not apply to a great business methodology, is we need to be doing them all concurrently.
So this is so fascinating because this is a repeating theme with a lot of entrepreneurs that I talk to. So I know you've talked about your strength as a connector and your business experience. So when you look at that challenge, how are you tackling it? Like, what's the secret to your success in making that happen?
I'm thinking on that. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to say this is maybe a completely left field answer is to say, I'm just not quitting. Part of it is, I think it's me personally, is I'm too stubborn to quit because I see such a massive opportunity. And I'm afraid if we just go, no, it will just organically take care of itself and somehow grow. And then we walk away. The opportunity may go away because somebody's not accelerating it at the right tables to get some of those things done. If that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Totally. Makes sense. So you're a prairie guy. You moved here. You fell in love with the ocean. Like, what is it about seaweed that is making you go crazy like this?
Well, I can answer that in short order. I put my business hat on and just go, the opportunities are monumental. And again, where else do you get the opportunity to do right by the environment and reignite coastal communities and start to rebuild some of those economies and transitioning economies, right? Like, those things are exciting to me. They're exciting. I just love to see when they come to fruition.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing that I find of interest is, and the young guys, Noss Foods is their company on the West Coast, they were doing some wild harvesting because they've been in the space for a while last summer. So during peak time in Tofino, busy spot we all know, where if you were trying to get a server to work in your restaurant, good luck. And they put up an ad basically for folks, whether those are students in biology or whatever it might be, to go, hey, we're going to do some wild harvesting. And by the way, it's hard work. Get out in a boat, pull in seaweed off a rope. Like, it's hard, onerous week. And the number, don't quote me on this, but they had like 50 or 60 people in days. They had just an overwhelming response. And I too get, I'm going to say once or twice a week, some, whether it's a master's student, like there's a lot of people in sciences, I'll say in general, trying to go like, how do I create a path into this industry, into this sector? And for us, if we can build out the sector, again, there should be some great, well-paying job opportunities in this space, which is, yet again, economic, you know, another checkbox.
Yeah, I love that. And so last question, you know, if there are other innovators looking to take on this kind of a challenge, what advice would you have for them?
You know, I have a mentor, a lifelong mentor that I look to in a lot of spaces. His commentary is simple. Pitch fearlessly. And that's just not about the proverbial pitch to your bank or to an investor or whoever it might be. Is just be steadfast in your commitment and belief that this is an opportunity. And I think, again, in trying to build out a whole net new sector and opportunity, it's going to take some time. And the word of the day, I think you used at the beginning of this conversation, is it's complex. It's complex, and there's a whole host of moving parts. And to try and, you know, every day when you start to go down paths, and I know for myself, I have conversations daily where I feel completely out of my depth, whether that's with a scientist in the space or business, what it might be. But I think if the story is so compelling, which is the translation to everybody else out there, is that if your story's compelling, I think the money and the enthusiasm and all the other pieces you need to make it successful will show up.
That's such a great summary. Thank you. And thank you for taking the time to share your work and your story with me. I have to say, your enthusiasm is infectious. You know, I'm sitting here, I'm excited for you and I'm rooting for you and I can't wait to see what comes next.
No, my pleasure. I was thrilled to be here. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Quest for Good, a story series about how innovators break down barriers to create a better future. If you liked the show, please subscribe, leave a review, or better yet, share it with your networks. And if you'd like to know more about how innovation stories can help you develop and sell your big idea, get in touch at denisewithers.com.